All right, if you have a Bible, we're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Last week, for those of us who were able to join us, we kicked off a new message series that we were calling Secret Lives. By the way, I posted that on Facebook. Did some of you see that, the link for the audio? Just so you know, we have a podcast that is kind of updated every week. So I've gotten some messages of, hey, could you post them on Facebook every week? We actually, we can do that. I mean, that's not hard to do. We can do that. But there's also, you can subscribe to the podcast either via iTunes or I believe it's Google Play, Android users. Yes? So you can subscribe to the audio and then my voice will be delivered into your phone every week. It's great. Last week we kicked off a new series talking about secrets and the things that within us, we like our secrets, the things we do, whether they're harmless, sometimes they're harmless, sometimes though they're not harmless and they actually begin eating away at us from the inside. And so last week we talked about those big secrets. What do we do with those? Because they tend to lead to all kinds of shame. And shame, as we described it last week, was that feeling that we are unloved or will not belong. And so many of us, because we have these things that happen to us, there's this person that God has wired you, created you to be. But then there's the things that we do or the things that are done to us that produces shame within us. And so we then put on a false self, a projected self. This is who I'm going to pretend to be to the world. And so last week we talked through that. We walked through that. This morning, I want to take it one layer deeper. And so last week we talked about how do we build shame? How do we get there? By the way, let me say this. I probably got more emails or phone calls or just conversations around that topic of shame than I've gotten in a long time. And so, I will let this morning be what this morning is, but next week I'm going to spend a little bit extra time on the subject of shame itself and what do we do with it. I actually have I've been keeping a list. I've got 15 practical things that people have said to me that go from parenting to body image to all those kinds of things. And next week, I just want to kind of tackle some of those issues. And so come back next week. I think, especially if you're trying to raise little people in this world, shame is a killer. It's a soul crusher. And so we want to walk through some of that. But this morning, I want to look at a story. And this story, it's one of those stories where I was trying to figure out how do we get through it. And the only way to get through this story is you just got to kind of walk through the whole story. You can't just skip verses in this one because this story is absolutely loaded. And so I want to show you a story in which a small thing becomes a big thing. What begins as a small, what appears to be not that big of a deal, it kind of gets a head of steam on it, and it becomes a major thing. Now, the reason I want to do this, two dominant reasons. If you this morning are contemplating or flirting with the idea of doing something that inside of you, you're like, okay, I know that's wrong, but, it doesn't hurt anybody. It's not going to hurt anything. My hope is that this morning, that little thing that you're thinking of maybe doing, that something would happen, something would shift, you would hear the voice of God and you would see that, that little thing actually can be a big deal and it can break somebody's heart. And so my hope is that for those who are flirting with the little things, this morning would be maybe I got to take that seriously. And then my second kind of big reason for this morning, my hope for this morning is I want to talk to those of you who right now feels like, okay, it was a big thing back then or a small thing back then, but now it's a big thing. I want to talk to those who are like, I have no idea how to get out of this thing. I am in it deep right now. I have this secret that honestly, if they did find out, they wouldn't love me. They wouldn't accept me. It's not just a feeling of shame. It's actually real. And I feel like I'm kind of beyond hope this morning. So I want to talk to those of you who are like flirting with the idea of trying something that may be a soul crusher. And I want to talk to those of you who right now feel like your soul has been crushed. And we're going to do that by looking at a story of a man named David. If you have a Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out to the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Let me pause there. There's an interesting couple of sentences there. It begins with, in the springtime, when kings go off to war, but it ends with David, who is the king, David is still back at Jerusalem, the capital city. He's still in Israel. It begins with when kings go off to war, but David remains in Jerusalem. So already you read the story and you've got like a bit of a, Like, well, what's going on in the story? Something like, why is David not with his troops? Why is David not with his soldiers? Why is David, in the time when kings go off to war, why is David not off at war? Why is David sent them, but actually he's hung back? So immediately in the story, like one or two sentences in, you have the sense that David is in a bad place. King David is in a bad place. Now, it is a bit surprising because the story we all know about David, like whether you grew up in a church or not, the story we all know about David is the story of David and Goliath. The first time we meet David, he's a boy. He's legally not even allowed to fight in the army. And he's saying, let me at him. Like he wants to take down a giant. The very first story is of a little boy when everyone else is scared saying, I want to march into the front lines because I think my God can take down Goliath. And it's a small stone from a small boy that takes down a giant. Small things in David's life lead to big change. But in this story, now David is the giant, kind of. Like David now has the power. He's the king. He's the one who sits on the throne. And David now, as an adult, he I don't want to go in there. You read the first couple sentences and you have the sense that the plane is flying upside down. Like, this is not how it's supposed to go. David has gotten an ego. David has let the power go to his head. David has been given a job of privilege, and David is now using that job of privilege to send them on the lines while he stays back. And so the story begins with David staying home, and it will end, if you follow it, we'll get here, it'll end with murder. So it begins with David, I'm just going to stay back. And it ends with David with innocent blood on his hands. Verse 2. Notice how it unfolds. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. Let's get a visual for that. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, she is Bathsheba. Then notice his language. She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. In other words, hey, who's that woman down there? Boss, her father, Eliam, your friend? That's Bathsheba. That's his daughter. Oh yeah. And maybe you know Uriah, her husband. It's like, boss, whatever you do, like, I know you see her from your palace. I know you're looking down on her. I know she's beautiful, but whatever you do, she's got a dad and she's got a husband. This is a bad idea. Verse 4, then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him and he slept with her. Now that language there is important. He slept with her. He slept with her. Typically, when the Bible talks about a consensual relationship, like two people that the consent in this, it'll use language like they slept together. Or they lay together often, it's said. But he slept with her kind of seems like, oh, we've got, like, this isn't her choice. This is force. Like, he's either using his power or actually using force to get Bathsheba. And then we have this line. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanliness, which is an odd detail. Would you agree? Like the author needs us to know that, oh, by the way, she was purifying herself from, uncleanliness. Now, why does the author need us to know this little particular detail? Well, there is a law in the Old Testament. It comes in Leviticus chapter 15. The law says this. When a woman has had her regular flow of blood, I'll let you explain that to the kids. The impurity of her monthly period will last 7 days, and anyone who touches her will be unclean till evening. So for 7 days, it goes on, for 7 days, she is to go through this purifying ritual. I mean, this is kind of the Old Testament law. David is the king. He's supposed to uphold the laws. So when we read that she's bathing, a couple questions come to my mind. How many times has David looked? Like, how many times has he stood on his palace looking down and seeing Bathsheba? 7? Was it every single day before he acted? Like, how many times does he look and say, ooh, before he actually acts. Second detail from this that we can imply. I think the reason the author needs us to know this, I think this is the big one. I think the reason the author needs us to know that she was doing her like legal duty is that this is not her fault. What's about to happen, what happened, is not her fault. She's the innocent victim. She was just doing what the law said to do. She was just bathing as the law said to bathe. It wasn't her that was looking down on her. It wasn't her that stepped into it. Again, the language of David slept with her matters. She's a victim. Verse 4. So the story, you see it escalating. It's David looks, David inquires, David invites, and then David sleeps. Verse 4. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a scandal, right? Now we have a scandal. What started as a look, like, oh, you know, like it's no big deal. It's just a look. Like, eh, it's no big deal. Just a look. What started as a look became an inquiry. Like, so who's this woman down there? Like, it's innocent. Like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with asking. Like, I'm just curious. Then it became an invitation. It won't hurt that we're hanging out. Like, it's not a big deal. Uriah's not even home. It's not a big deal. That became an affair. That became an action. David sleeps with her. So it started as a look, like, oh, it's no big deal. Just looking off the menu. I'm not going to order. Whatever language he uses. Becomes, David sleeps with her. See all the things? Like, it starts like a, we said last week, it starts with like a little bit of dirt. And then it kind of becomes a little bit more. And then a little more. This is kind of fun. And a little more. And now we have a scandal because now she comes back the next day and she says to David, David, I'm pregnant. Uh-oh. And now what you see in David is David's got to cover it up. David's got to hide this. He has a couple options. He could at this moment come clean. Right? Like, this is the moment that a lot of us find ourselves in. We've done the thing. We kind of got caught. It caught up to us. And in that moment, there is the opportunity to come clean and say, I messed up. I'll make it good on Uriah. Like, I'll make sure we take care of you, but I messed up. Or you can do what most of us choose to do, and you can double down. Like, oh, I can still cover this up. David's smart. David knows that he's a smart man with power. He can cover this thing up. He can throw just a little bit more dirt on it because we don't want him to find that layer. So if we just throw a little bit more dirt on it, then no one will know. We'll just cover it up. Verse 6. So David sent this word to Joab. Send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Yeah, so you have this like, just playing it cool. How's the war going? How are the soldiers? Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. Okay? So Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba, comes in. He calls him back. He plays it cool. Like, how's everything going? You doing okay? Okay, go home and wash your feet. Now, okay, this could get a bit awkward, but let me explain something to you all. I wrestled with whether to include this, but I think it's helpful to understand the story. But it could be a bit awkward. So the phrase wash your feet is a Hebrew idiom. You know what I mean when I say idiom? Idiom is a figure of speech that culturally they would have understood. Culturally, the people, it's kind of like when we say, Jared cut the cheese. You all understand what that means. That's a bad example, maybe. It's an unfair to Jared. I just love that man. So, but like, if I have to say it's raining cats and dogs, you understand what that means. That means it's raining hard. When, in the Hebrew language, when you come across the phrase, to wash your feet or to uncover your feet, feet is often used as a Hebrew idiom for, and again, this could get awkward, but like, put your adult mind on, for male genitalia in the Bible. So, for instance, you have the description of the angels throughout the Bible. And the angels are described as having six wings. With two, they fly, of course. With two, they cover their eyes, because you cannot look upon the face of God and live. And it says with two, they covered their feet. So often in pictures, you see two tiny little like wings on their feet. But this is to understand the idiom is to understand, like, no, what the author is trying to tell us is that they're actually naked, but they cover their nudity. Does this make sense? The story of, I'll keep giving examples until you nod and say it makes sense. Please stop giving examples. Story of Ruth and Boaz. So Ruth comes to Boaz's tent, and in the story it says she uncovers his feet. And then she says, you're a Jew. You have to take care of me, a poor widow or a poor foreigner, because you're a Jew. And so we say, well, what is it about Jewish feet? Like, how do you know from his feet that he's a Jew? What she's saying is you're circumcised. You're Jewish. You have to take care of me. Does this make sense? Oh, I hope we got that on the podcast. That's fantastic. So when David sees Uriah, this is my point. When David sees Uriah and is like, how's it going, buddy? How's the war going? Things going okay? You know what? Uriah, you've been working hard. Go home and wash your feet. What he's saying is go home and be with your wife. Like, fulfill your husbandly duty, whatever language you want to use, whatever euphemism we would use. But go home and lay with your wife. Now, do you understand why he would say this? You get it? She's pregnant. She's pregnant. You see his plan? It's quite clever. Like, he calls Uriah home and he you know what, Uriah, you've been working hard. Go home and sleep with your wife, and then we'll send you back off to war. The next time you come home, your wife will be beginning to show, and you will assume it's because, well, you came home and you had that night. And David will be off the hook. Quite clever. Like Zach Morris level. Clever. Verse 8. I just love using like random, like that upper millennial, like 35-year-olds only understand the joke. Love it. Verse 8. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept, get this, but Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to his house. You catch it? Like, if you're David, you're freaking out. He did what? He did what? Like, I brought him home. Go be with your wife. But he doesn't. David was told Uriah did not go home. So he asked Uriah, haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why don't you go home? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my Lord's men, your guys, David, are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. Essentially, he says, my buddies, my friends, our nation is at war. Why would I go home and live as though like life was just normal when my friends are laying their life on the line? I surely as I live, I will not do that. I will not do that. While they're fighting, I'll stay at your door, but I'm not going home to be with Bathsheba until all of us come home. And now you get a sense that David is getting desperate. Verse 12. Then David said to him, stay here one more day and tomorrow I will send you back. You ever find yourself like, I just got to buy myself some time. I'll figure out a plan. We're going to set up by him. It's a good story, isn't it? So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him. So if you're going to stay at my door, have some wine. Have some more wine. And David made him drunk. Because if we can get him drunk, then drunk enough, he'll be like, okay, maybe I will go home to see Bathsheba. See his plan? But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servant. He did not go home. So if you're David, what do you do in this moment? Your plan is completely unraveling. Apparently, Uriah is just too good of a dude. He's not going to go home to Bathsheba. What do you do if you're David? Your secret that you've been hiding, you've been burying, you've been trying, you've been creating these elaborate schemes and these elaborate plans. Your secret is about to become exposed. What do you do? You can come clean, always an option, or you can double down. Verse 14. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he'll be struck down and die. So while Joab was While Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Essentially, he kills him. Put him in a place, then leave him. Put him in the front of the line and then leave him. Now pay attention to this phrase, moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Because you will discover that phrase comes up again and again and again. It's almost like the author wants you to know, don't miss the point of this. This is where it gets you. This is where the little look will lead. Verse 18, Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, when you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up and he may ask you, why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal-sheth? Didn't a woman drop an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why did you get so close to the wall? If he asks you this, then say to him, moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. You get what he's saying? Hey, go home, report to David. And you have to say to David, we lost the war. We lost the fight. And he'll probably get pretty angry with you. How did you lose the fight? Like, he'll probably come at you and say, why did you get so close to the wall? You know not to fight by getting that close to the wall. But when he does, just say to him, oh, and by the way, wink, Uriah's dead. Oh, don't worry about it. Yeah, you're fine. You're fine. And now we have more people implicated in David's sin. More people are caught up in the secret. More people. This is how it works, isn't it? What started out as just, one drink ain't going to hurt me. I know I've been sober for a while now, but one drink isn't going to hurt me. And now family systems are involved. And now extended family. And now work's getting involved. One little look, you know, one cup of coffee's not going to hurt me. One cup of coffee with her. Like, we're just going to talk work. We're just going to talk shop. And pretty soon, more people get involved, and more people get involved, and before you know it, your friends are like, they don't know who you are anymore, and now you've got lawyers talking. This is the story. Verse 22. The messenger set out, and when he arrived, he told David everything Joab had sent him to say. The messenger said to David, the men overpowered us and came out against us in the open, but we drove them back to the entrance of the city gate. Then the archer shot down arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, so we didn't do good, but moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. Mention number three, subtle wink. Don't worry, it's taken care of. Verse 25. David told the messenger, say this to Joab, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as the other. Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Joab. Wink, I get it. I know, we lost. That happens. No big deal. Just keep trying. Just keep trying. I get it. You're fine, Joab. Verse 26, when Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. By the way, I don't even know how to describe that sentence. She mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. And then this line, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. That's the story. So David is viewed as a hero by the people, more than likely. But it displeased the Lord, we read. David more than likely is like, the people are like, hey, David, you're a pretty good dude. Because he goes on and he marries Bathsheba. He raises this child. Hey, remember when Uriah came home? He must have been with Bathsheba and she got pregnant. But look at David. Look at how he supports the troops. Like when Uriah, her husband, died, he takes Bathsheba in. He raises her kids as though they are his own. Like David, cheers to David. He's the greatest king in the world. He gets away with it. Kind of. Almost. I mean, but that line, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. Now let me, again, walk back through it. What started out as a look becomes, I wonder if she's like, can you find out about Bathsheba? Like, she's single. Is she into me? I'm the king. Is she into me? Well, then it becomes, actually, she's got a She's got a dad. He's your buddy. He's your friend. And she's actually married right now. Don't go by her. Okay, let me send down some messengers to get her. We'll just talk for a little bit. Like, it's not going to hurt anyone. And then it becomes you can't, Bathsheba, I'm the king. You can't say no to me. I will ruin you. I will kill your husband. So Bathsheba then comes back and says, but David, I'm pregnant. You got me pregnant. Oh man, how are we going to get out of this? I have an idea. We'll get Uriah here and we'll like give him a little time off. And then like he'll assume it's his baby. Brilliant. But the problem is Uriah is too nice of a dude. He won't even go to be with his wife. And so Uriah refuses. Well, what do you do? You can come clean or you can double down. And so he says, you know what I'll do is I'll just send him to the front line and kill him. And he gets away with it. Almost. Almost. Because that's how it almost always works. We get away with it until we don't, right? We're getting away with it until the moment where we get caught. Let me read you the next story. Verse 1 of the next chapter. The Lord sent David. This is the very first parable ever in the Bible. This will be Jesus' favorite strategy for preaching. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town. One was rich and the other was poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except for one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food. This little baby lamb drank from his cup and even slept in his arms. This lamb was like a daughter to this poor man. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the baby lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. Catch the story? David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity on that poor man. Then Nathan said to David, this is one of my favorite lines in the Bible, you are the man. And that one sentence changes David. The one sentence turns David. And I would argue that one sentence saves David. If you skip down to verse 13, you read this. David says, I have sinned against the Lord. And then Nathan replies, the Lord has taken away your sin. And that's the story. I mean, it's like a mix of scandal and Game of Thrones and like cable news. I mean, it's just crazy. It starts with a look. He invites her up. He sleeps with her. He gets her pregnant. How about we get you drunk? You go home. Like, you'll do your thing. He gets her. Like, doesn't work. Starts with a look, and it ends with murder. How many of us have ever had this moment where you stand over the pile, and you're like, how on earth did it get here? I want to give you two obvious observations. I had a gentleman approach me a couple weeks ago, and he said, Tim, my favorite sermons you preach are the ones where you teach something that I already knew. I'm like, oh, thanks. But he goes, my favorite sermons are the ones where I already knew that. I just actually never allowed myself to think about that. So let me give you two observations. You already know this. This is not shocking to you. You already know this, but maybe we need to think about it. First observation, obvious observation. Observation number one, it never starts with murder. That's obvious, right? Never starts with murder. I think this is what Jesus is getting at when he says, like, hey, if you lust in your heart, it's as bad. If you have anger in your heart, it's just as bad. It never starts with murder. How about we say it this way? It never starts with addiction. No one signs their yearbook and says, you know, dear Susie, can't wait to see you again at our 20-year reunion. I will be completely wasted and I will be totally addicted to it. No one sets out for that. No one sets their life up for a path of, I'm just gonna risk my health. I'm gonna throw my friends to the wind. I am going to find myself in a spot where it's a thunderstorm. It's a freezing rainstorm. And I'm gonna be finding myself, I need the fix so bad that I'll risk my life, get in my car to get it. No one sets out on the path of, I need more so bad that right now I can't even see straight, but I will risk somebody else's life down the street to get it. No one signs a yearbook that way. Never starts with murder. It never starts with murder. Maybe say it this way. It never starts as an affair. Never starts as an affair. No one gets up on their wedding day and says, someday, I vow that I will cheat on you, and I vow that I will hide it for a while, and then I vow that, we'll find ourselves in a custody battle over the kids. No one starts there. Little girls dream about putting the ring on their finger. No little girl dreams about taking the ring off her finger. It never starts there. Never starts with murder. Never starts with Cats in the Cradle. Remember that song? Cats in the Cradle. Never starts there. Never starts workaholism. Never starts with, someday I'm going to have this child, but I'm going to be so I'm going to want to feed this child so much. I'm going to take care and bring home the bacon so badly that I will never see my children. I'll never show up to the games. I'll never show up to the practices. It actually never starts there, does it? It always starts with a look. I've been sober for a while. I can have one. It always starts with a small step, a little bit of dirt. And then a little more, and then a little more, and then a little more. The David story is actually how it works. It's ugly and it's vulgar, and it's like, can we say this in front of our kids? But that's actually how how the enemy works. Remember the story in Genesis 3? It's just a piece of fruit. Didn't God say, oh, come on, it's not a big deal, Adam, Eve. It's not a big deal. Not a big deal. He'll be fine. He's a good guy. He's a good God. He'll be fine. Right? It always starts just don't worry about it. Obvious observation number one. Obvious observation number two. Grace is scandalous. This is a big one. Because how many of you, you read a story like this and you're like, okay, David heard a story about a little lamb, and then there's I'm sorry. And it's oh, no worries. That should kind of make us mad, right? David hears a story about a baby lamb, and he's he's done all this stuff. He's literally everything you can think of that is bad, he's done it. And then he hears a story about a baby lamb, and he's oh man, I feel really bad. And then we hear from Nathan, oh, God says you're forgiven. Don't worry about it. Grace is scandalous. It's not fair. In fact, in the New Testament, Old and New Testament, you will hear David described as a man after God's own heart. He becomes a hero in the Bible. And how many of you have ever thought, what about justice? What about justice? And you definitely will find justice in this story if you keep reading. There's justice that's served. But the most scandalous thing about our God is not our God's justice. Hear me in this. A lot of people will say, I walked away from church because all they talk about is how God is angry at these people. God is angry. That's actually not the scandalous thing about God. The scandalous thing about God is his grace. That he forgives people who totally ruin it. That he gives people a second shot and a third shot and a hundredth shot that totally blow it. That you read a story like David and you hear David and it's oh, I forgive you. And it's no, that's too far. That's the part that I think this is why we invent entire religious systems where we're we got to draw a new line and some pretty loose sand, because we actually aren't comfortable with that level of grace. We actually aren't comfortable with, I don't know that I can give them a new shot. Grace is scandalous. The biblical story is scandalous because God continues to find ways, invent ways to forgive people who come to him and are heartbroken. The story that you hear about David, the story that God allows us to tell about David, is that David is a man after God's own heart. But I would argue from this story, that's actually not the best telling of the story. While it is the one that God says, here's how I want you to tell the story, David was a man after my heart, the best telling of this story is that we serve a God who is after man's own heart. Our God is passionately in pursuit for our heart. And all he needs for David to see is that the ugly, disgusting, sinful, whatever language you want to use, this pile of blah that his life has become. That all he wants David to see is that this thing that your life has become, do you see what it's doing? And all David has to do is say, oh God, please help me out of it. I feel the shame. I feel the weight of it. And God is waiting to give him freedom. Just waiting to give him freedom. See, what we get when we first meet, or when the point at the end of the story is, we get David's false self, his projected self, and it takes the point where David gets to the end of his rope, the very end of himself, where God says, okay, now we have some ground we can cover. Now that you've gotten to the very end of yourself, all the shame, all the pride, I've got some friends in the recovery movement, and they will say the number one thing we battle is pride. And we know somebody's ready to be sober when they get to the spot where they're not worried about telling somebody anymore that they're an addict. Now we get to this. Now God has something he can work with. The number one, like, he gets to the spot of, I'm hopeless. I can't get through it. It's the reason why every single, like, recovery movement, not just AA or NA, but like every recovery movement, every marriage class will start with, okay, if you want to have this marriage work, You're gonna find yourself with piles, and you're gonna think, you know, I'll just work harder to dig myself out of this pile. If you want to actually know the secret, here's the secret. The first step is you name that you need a higher power. You need a greater strength of source, like source of strength. You need a stronger God than you, because you can't save you. You've tried to save you. I've tried to save me, but you can't save you. Every effort you did to try harder to, I'll just get the bottles out of the house. I'll just make sure, like, I block her from Facebook. Everything we did on our, like, okay, we can come up with a plan. Like, we still found ourselves digging a hole. And every effort we tried to undig the hole, we found ourselves falling into the hole deeper. And so the scandal of the gospel is you actually can't do that, but he will. And all you have to do is ask. Our God is a God who reaches in the dirt and pulls up people. This is the prayer that David writes on the back end of this. And I would argue, if you're in a spot this morning, it's the most helpful prayer you can pray. I'll give you the passage, but bring it home and pray it. And if you don't know how to sum up this prayer, if you need a word, I would suggest the word help. I think it's the most powerful prayer you'll ever pray, is just to say to God, God, help. But let me read you Psalm 51 and we'll wrap up. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me, yet you desired faithfulness even in the womb. You taught me wisdom in that secret place. Cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean. Wash me and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face from my sins. Blot out my iniquity. Create in me a pure heart, O God. Renew a steadfast spirit in me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Do you get the desperate nature of the prayer? Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Then I will teach transgressors your ways so that sinners will turn back to you. Deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God. You who are God, my Savior, and my tongue will sing of your righteousness. Open my lips, Lord, and my mouth will declare your praise. You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. You, God, will not despise. May it please you to prosper Zion, to build up the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in the sacrifices of the righteous and burnt offerings offered whole. Then bulls will be offered at your altar. Let's make it about someone else, he says. My prayer, my sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit and a broken heart. If you right now are in a space where it's like you work all day, you come home, you pull your car in the garage, but you spent the entire day working because you knew that the fight at home was going to be worse and the marriage has just not been healthy. It's not been good. I suggest the prayer, help me, Jesus. More than any marriage class, those are great. More than any counseling, that's fantastic. I suggest a simple prayer before you turn the car ignition off, the simple prayer in the garage, Jesus, help me. I don't know how to be a good husband. I don't know how to be a good wife. I don't know how to deal with this spouse that you've given me. Help, help, help. Before you open the cabinet and are looking for the next thing, the next drink, maybe you simply open the, maybe write the word help right on the cabinet and just pray the prayer, God, help me. I actually don't have the strength to not drink that. Help me. Help me, help me, help me. Maybe it's you place it on the mirror and you stare at the mirror, and every time you think about hurting your own body, every time you think about whispering a voice to yourself saying, I'm too ugly, I'm not smart enough, I'm definitely not thin enough, I'm not worthy. Maybe you simply put the prayer on the window, on the mirror, and you write the word help. Jesus, help me see you as you see me. My sacrifice, God, is a broken heart. That's all I got, is a broken heart. I believe the scandal of our God, the scandalous nature of our God, is that our God, when we get to the end of our rope, our God is constantly longing, looking to pull us out of it. But as long as we're trying to cover it up and play in the sand, he'll let us. He'll let us. Jesus. Lord, I pray for the person in the room right now who feels like, oh man, I hope my spouse isn't listening too much to this because this is right for me. Lord, I pray that you would break them open so that you could heal them. Lord, I pray for, again, as we prayed at the beginning, as we named at the beginning, Lord, I pray for the person in this room who thinks they're beyond hope. And I pray that this morning you would restore hope to them. And Lord, I pray for the person in this room, the people in this room, Lord, who think that, oh, just a little flirting, just a little, that's not going to hurt anything. Lord, I pray that your spirit would convict them. Jesus, I pray that you would make your church healthier. Lord, I pray that you would continue to make us as a community. Lord, help us to sharpen each other so that our world would look in and say, oh, they're not hypocrites at all. They're doing it. And so Jesus, we cannot do this on our own. We've tried. And so we cry out to you, help. And Jesus, we thank you in advance because you know we know you respond to that prayer. So Lord, we say this all in your name. We love you, Jesus. Amen.